From an early age, we're all immersed in sport. For some, it fails to ignite a spark inside us, but for those of us who catch the fire, it's the beginning of a lifelong journey filled with highs and lows, which all matter far more than they should. After all, it's just a game, we're told. Sport is a certainty, it's a point of reference in an increasingly uncertain world, and the bonds formed with either sport in general or a hometown club transcend both time and generations. Today, much of what sport has always meant to true fans has been somehow lost in a blizzard of corporate communications, fireworks, and froth. The attachments that were once so strong seem more trivial in the global age of televised sport as entertainment. What was once authentic has become increasingly staged. In this podcast, we'll get back to the things that sport has always meant to true fans. We'll take you from the boardroom to the dressing room to the pitch, but we'll do it not as a corporate communication, but as true fans of sport, and we'll do it with authenticity. We'll be honest, and we'll speak our minds. This is a podcast for true sports fans, and the one thing all fans have in common is a passion for the game. Now, we certainly don't mean to cause any offence, so if you find yourself taking any, just shrug it off and get back in the game, because this is about the game, and the game is bigger than all of us.
We've got some fresh new young talent doing some things that I know you haven't heard before.
Listen.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? We have a special guest joining us this week, which I'll get Roger to talk to you about in a minute. But before we do that, let's bring him in. Rog, are you there? Are you in the lake? Are you by the lake? Where are you?
I'm in Switzerland again, Lugano Lake. But yes, another lake, another day.
Another day, another lake. Exactly right. How are you, my friend?
I'm very good. How are you, Granddad?
Yes, good. I'm back to fighting off a cold, which seems to be almost like a job for me lately, but I think I'm succeeding this time, which makes a nice
good
trip.
Good to hear it. Okay, Grant, before we get into introducing Federico Schmino, I've got a couple of little talking points as usual, if you've got time.
I think we can make time for you, Rog.
Okay, so I'd like to start off with an own goal, which I know you love, which is the incident with Matt Kuchar and Sergio Garcia.
Yes.
Now, isn't it funny? We talked about Matt Kuchar about 4 weeks ago, whether he was a good guy, a bad guy, got a good rap or a bad rap, and there he goes again. Is he an innocent victim, or is he a wolf in sheep's clothing? For people that don't know, he refused to give a gimme to Sergio Garcia, who then backhanded it and missed the putt. And I said, since it wasn't
well, it's a little bit more complicated.
Okay, you do it. You're the golf guy.
So what happened was Garcia missed a putt in the World Match Play Championship and left himself a putt that was a clear gimme. There is no way Kuchar would not have given him that putt. But before Kuchar had the chance to give it to him, Garcia, in a fit of pique, sort of kind of swiped at it to knock it into the hole and missed. Now, the rules state that because Kuchar hadn't given it to him, it technically counts the shot, so Kuchar would win the hole. Now, the initial summation from the announcers was that, oh, you know, that the rules official was called in and the rules official ruled that Kuchar won the hole. Kuchar said he would have given it to Sergio, but the rules official said, no, I'm sorry, because you didn't, then you win the hole. What it turns out actually happened was Kuchar basically said to the rules official, well, you know, I would have given it, but I didn't give it. I don't know what happens next. Clearly, Kuchar knows exactly what happens next and knows he wins the hole. And so that's what happened. And there was obviously there was a lot of tension in the air for the remaining sort of five or six holes. But interestingly, Rog, after that, what's come out is a lot of people now have actually started to stick it to Kuchar, which they didn't do after the thing we spoke about in Mexico. We've had Paul McGinley come out and say that the whole thing's a big fraud and he's actually a nasty guy. And a couple of others have kind of cast doubts on him. So it's interesting how the world spins, you know?
My oh my, it takes you a lifetime to build up a reputation, but it takes you 30 seconds to lose one. And I think his is gone.
Well, I think he'll struggle after that. We'll see. It'll be interesting. It will be very, very interesting, particularly if the two of them get paired at the next Ryder Cup. That will be very interesting. Well, what was your goal of the week?
Well, the goal is not really a goal, but I enjoyed it. So I'll call it a Schadenfreude goal, which is the decisions against Cardiff at the weekend and Neil Warnock.
Yeah.
Now, and why am I including that? Because it's in the same period that Cardiff are still continuing with this most awful, tawdry behaviour about...
It's terrible.
Well, so isn't it just poetic justice that the footballing gods give them the most awful refereeing decisions against them at a time when they're trying to wiggle out for paying for Salah? I think it's just right.
Yeah, do you know what? I was going to bring those contract negotiations up in last week's Goal on Goal. We ran out of time. I mean, it's shameful. It really is what's going on with that whole Emiliano Sala thing. It's just awful to make a tragedy something like that. I mean, in some way, I understand why they're doing it, but somebody should just sit down and say, guys, you know what? It's a lot of money, but we've got to swallow this, because the PR damage it's doing to them is going to, I think, cost them a lot more than paying out the contract would.
Well, not only that, as I say, you know, what are they trying to save? 8 million, 9 million? If they go down, that's a lot more. And, you know, maybe the gods are saying that, well, listen, you'll go down then if that's the way you're going to do it. I'm not saying the referees are in any way doing that deliberately, but sport and football's got one hell of a way of paying you back when you're not behaving properly.
Yeah, it's a good point. Since you've done that, I've got one of mine that I'll mention, and that is the Elite Eight level of the NCAA basketball tournament. You know, this tournament never ever fails to provide everything you could ever want as a sports fan. You know, to me, even if you're not a fan of basketball, you should follow this tournament, because every single year you get drama, you get tension, you get stories, you get buzzer beaters. And once again, the games this weekend where we saw number one seeds who were expected to win get knocked off in overtime or buzzer beating shots. It's such an unbelievable event. It's the only big event in the US that I haven't been to see yet. One of these years I have to go to the Final Four, because every year it delivers. And this year, I say, we've got the Final Four weekend coming up, the 8th, I think it's the 8th and 10th, or the 6th and 8th, maybe. That it's next weekend anyway. And that, again, I'm going to set and be glued to all three games, because I guarantee there's going to be fireworks.
Absolutely. Mark Yusko mentioned that, and maybe he'll take you to one of those games. But it's every year, March Madness is just fantastic.
All right. Well, Raj, why don't you just let people know who we are about to talk to, because this should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, we're being joined today by Federico Smaino, who you'll hear him speaking wonderful English, but is actually an Italian, an ex-football player, professional football player, who then went on to be very important in the league here in Italy with all its Machiavellian ups and downs. And he's now moved on to the wonderful group of Antonio Gozzi, which includes Y Scout, that great football analytic company. He himself runs Y Lab, which is the top sports accelerator in Italy. And in his spare time, he is a big part of the commercial side of Intella, which is the family club, which will be back in Serie B very soon. So he sees football from all different angles, incredibly well educated, sensitive guy, and somebody who thinks a lot about the game.
Well, let's bring him in. Federico, welcome to Are You Not Entertained?
Ciao, Federico.
Ciao, Roger.
Come stai?
All good here, all good.
Okay. Good, listen, I'm glad you've switched to your wonderful English. Let me introduce you, Grant Williams, my partner in crime.
Federico, great to have you on. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Listen, Federico, let's jump straight in. One of the reasons we wanted you on is that you've been a big supporter of the podcast and like very much what we've been trying to do here. And you know that very much the style of the podcast, which is, first of all, we want to get under the skin of our guest to find out their passion for sport in the way that we say in the introduction, where you get that connection immediately. And your story is a remarkable one. And so we'll go through that, and then we'll get into basically what you do now, what your experience in the football world has been. But tell us a little bit how you got involved in sport, in football, and that even led you to a professional footballing career.
Okay. So I started playing football in the street. I was born in a 20,000 people town in the northeastern part of Italy, in the province of Padova. For the ones of you who know what I'm talking about, it's not far from Venice. I started playing in the street with my friends. I had my brother, who's 6 years older than me. He was a goalkeeper. And so we had a team called Kennedy, because that was a street I lived in, so Kennedy Street, and JFK Kennedy. And so with our team, we would play against the other neighbors.
Yeah, and I was just like everybody.
Just like everybody. I was the youngest, and we were all AC Milan fans. So I have this picture. This is black and white picture I use when I do my presentation sometimes. And I say, you know, this is a black and white picture, so you can't say actually what club supported. But this I can tell you, this is the best club in Milan, and definitely the club who won more Champions League. So everyone laughs and says, okay, we understand, this is AC Milan. So this is my. So we started. I started in the street, then I started playing football for the local club, and I was. You know, I happened to be pretty good, I would say, as a young footballer. So I was picked by the Padova, which is by the way
good
one
team.
Of
very good team.
It's a do you say traditional club?
Kind
of traditional club. It's in Serie B now. It's in second division, but it was, you know, Nereo Rocco's team. So one of the most famous coaches of the Italian. It was a coach of also a manager. Sorry, manager of AC Milan as well. So he's really well known in Italy. And I started playing for Padova when I was 11. And that was my, I would say, my start with football, because my dad would bring me to the matches on Sunday morning. And on Sunday afternoon, I would start going to the stadium. That was Lapiani Stadium, Stadium Appiani, which was the old stadium in Padova. It's a very... And I say, if you see this stadium now, it's a car park, I guess. Yeah. And it was a very nice stadium, because you could also go to the stadium and on the rooftop of some houses around the stadium. Even if you didn't have the tickets, you could jump. You know, there were lots of people following the club and actually going to the game, but on the rooftop of the houses around the stadium.
Fede, is that the Padua generation that had Del Piero?
Yes, I'm 1 year older than Del Piero, but unfortunately, I changed team. After 4 years at Padua, I went to Vicenza. Vicenza is 20 kilometers away from Padua. A very good team as well, very traditional.
Paolo Rossi team.
Paolo Rossi's team, exactly. Roberto Baggio's team. And many others, and I guess you remember that they've done some Coppa delle Coppe, which is the I don't know what's the name of that, but it's an international European
Cup Winners' Cup.
Yeah, Cup to come with Chelsea. I think they were eliminated by in the final, I guess, with Chelsea, or in the semi final. So very good team, very good fan base. So I played with for Vicenza for 3 seasons, and we play against Del Piero, by the way, in Primavera, which is the championship right before the professional level. So yeah. I played against him, and he didn't do anything that game apart from 2 shots. One was a penalty kick, and the other was a free kick, and both shots were goals.
There you go. You can see it early, can't you?
Absolutely fantastic player, and just one game, but it was honestly, that was my experience with Del Piero. And then I had a very, let me say, peculiar story as a football player, because when I was 18, usually when you are 18, you usually get hired, or you get a professional, you sign a professional contract with a club, usually. But all the team I would play with at Vicenza, we were sent to non-professional leagues at that time. Maybe they didn't believe we were a good group, maybe. And so I started playing for a non-professional club not far from where I lived, Rovigo, which is not far from Padova. And I was a student. So I went to university. I studied economics at the University of Bologna. And then I started playing good football. I started growing myself physically, mentally, tactically. A coach found me the right position in the field. I'm a mediano, just defending midfielder. But I was good with my feet as well, so I was not bad in trying to, make the pace of the team, just giving the rhythm of the team, moving the ball. And so I started playing football professionally. At the same time, I graduated in economics. So this is a strange part of my story because I'm a sort of a student athlete, a student player. And this is rare. This is not common because usually either you play football or you study. That's the end of the story. So this is my beginning with sport. Then I played 11 years professionally. I've done 470 games, 270 professionally, 200 non-professional leagues. I actually played in all leagues from Serie B. I've never played in Serie A, from Serie B till non-professional leagues. And then I've done a master in strategies for the business of sports, which is a very good master. Sort of an MBA, and I was hired by the Italian Division Second League, which is a Lega Calcio, Lega Serie B, which is the second division, Italian second division football. And I spent 8 years of my life in Milan, where the league is based. And then 6 months ago, I moved to become the CEO of the first Italian sports tech incubator. So something completely different from the work I'd done for the league. But I had the chance, I was lucky enough to see football from within the stadium. I was a player, so I've breathed the grass of the stadium, the grass of the grounds, you know, the emotion, the atmosphere of the stadium. I was lucky to see football from a manager's point of view of the league, of the football league, and now I'm seeing football and sports from another perspective. So I consider myself lucky.
I'm rolling my sleeves up here. There's so much to talk about there, Federico. It's a fascinating story. I we'll definitely come on to that student athlete thing in a little while because that is very rare and important. But I want to stick with your experience as a player first, if we can, for a little while. I want to talk about some of the other great players that you may have played against because I'm always fascinated when you come up against someone like a Del Piero, even at a young age. As a player on the same field, when you come across a talent like that, what does it feel like? I mean, you can tell that they're special. I mean, what does that feel like, and what does that make you feel in your own head about your own talent and your future in the game when you see the likes of a Del Piero shirted up against you?
Well, it was the 1980s, so Del Piero was nothing. Compared to what it is now in terms of fame and popularity, okay? Because it was not the Del Piero we know he is today. But I can tell you, we already knew he was strong because everyone was commenting or talking about him. So it was, yes, I agree with you. He had a sort of an aura. He had a feeling that you were playing with someone who is different. And it doesn't happen often when you play football. I play with very good players. Nothing really, obviously, I can tell you some names in some cases. I played with Luca Toni, for example. You may know Luca Toni.
Wow, absolutely. World Cup winner.
Yes, I played with Tommaso Rocchi, another good friend of mine, captain of Lazio, for example. I played with Marco Borriello, AC Milan player.
Oh, wow. Great.
Good. I played with these kinds of players. And by the way, I played with this player when we relegated from Serie B to Serie C in Treviso. So sometimes you have good players, not Luca Toni. Luca Toni was in Serie B. Sometimes even when you have good players, it doesn't mean you're going to succeed. But to go back to your question, yes, I had a feeling that was a special day, and that was a special player, even if that particular guy didn't do anything particularly exciting. But you see, you know, how the way he moves, the way he touches the ball, the way he is it's like you understand there's something different with this person, and everything that followed that game proved that it was special as a player. And then, of course, I don't know him personally, but the impression that I have from the media and what people say about him also is a very good guy. So he's very, I would say, yes, simple and good guy. So that adds to my first impression. But yes, it has a feeling of some special footballer. Yes.
So Freddie, you talked about relegation there, and as you may or may not have heard from the podcast, my team is Fulham, so I'm getting braced for the rubber stamping of our relegation this year from the Premier League down to the Championship. Fortunately, I've had 50 odd years to get used to that feeling, and I've experienced it on many, many occasions. But what is that like as a player? Because, you know, I think from the fans' perspective, you watch your team. And you know, when you get promoted or you win cups, it's a tremendous feeling, and everyone can feel that together. But when you're relegated as a player, particularly if it's maybe your first season at the club or you've only been there a couple of years, you know, for the fans, this is a lifelong association, and you suffer all the pain and the sorrow. As a player, what's it like to be relegated, particularly if you've only kind of just started your association with the club?
It's a nightmare. I mean, the way I lived it, it happened more than once in my career, unfortunately. I think I had more relegation than promotions. And so it's very bad. I mean, it's like, it's depression is when you lose. You know, basically, you know that in the beginning of the season that you might be a winner. In some cases, you might save yourself, as we say that in England, in Italy, and then you might even relegate. And I tell you, my experience with that was really bad. And of course, I understand fans. When I played football, sometimes, you know, I didn't understand fans, and especially the ultras group, the more diehard fans, the kind of omnibus kind of fans, if you will, and. And what happened is that when we would lose games, I remember in Treviso, the second season, Treviso doesn't have a big fan base, doesn't even have a famous fan base, but they, you know, even if it's 200 or 300 people shouting at you when you go out of the stadium and shouting, you know, any kind of bad things or, you know, all their frustration towards you, I can tell you this is something that doesn't leave you indifferent. At least for myself, I've always been a very, I would say, maybe too sensitive of a player. I was always thinking if I was doing the right thing, and maybe that was my drawback, my weak points, because sometimes, you know, when you do a mistake in the field, and sometimes, you know, I heard Zerder say that when you make a mistake as a player, The greatness of you as a player is not thinking of that mistake and going on, and maybe do the same kind of play, and that way, if nothing happened before. I was not like that, honestly. If I did a mistake,
Federico,
and people started. Yeah,
Federico, that is so interesting, because I've had the luck to meet a good few, you know, real top class elite athletes in sport over the years, and they all say that same thing. They say at a certain point it's all in the head that makes the difference. I know you quite well. You are a very reflective, cerebral, you know, sensitive guy, and you know, I can imagine what you're just saying there, and you feeling it very hard. You know, some of the real top guys that I've come across, they all say, you know, you maybe come down a little notch, but you're right back up there. You have to do that. You know, so did you see when you were like at that stage of your career, those kind of like crucial years between 16, 18, that you had that kind of like defect, and did you try and change it, or was it something you couldn't do anything about?
I don't know. I've always been self judgmental. Do you say that? Self-judging.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So when my father would bring me to a match when I was a young player, or I knew he was coming to the game because he followed me. You know, he was a professional. He was an engineer, but he followed me as much as he could, and I felt the pressure, honestly, from a kid father perspective. And I felt the pressure because when I played good, he was happy. I was, brilliant. And when I played not so good or didn't play even, it was depressed. And I felt the burden of this kind of responsibility. As a matter of fact, when I lost my father, I was 22 years old, and I would play for non-professional league. And I, of course, you know, I've suffered as you can imagine. But then I started playing good football. I don't know if that's just a coincidence, because as I told you, I was not prepared as a football player. Even at 18 or 19 or 20, I was a kid, and then from a physiological perspective, I've grown up a lot when I was 21 and 22. So maybe that's just a coincidence. But it's like, I love my father, of course, but it was like getting rid of, you know, his pressure from the shoulders on some case. But maybe this is part of my character, because I've always been like that. I always thought that maybe if I didn't judge myself or my performances the way I did, I would have done better than I did. And so I was always looking for means to do better. Like, once I tried the diet, the zone diet. Do you know the zone, which worked for me in 2000? I was one of the first, I think, athletes to try the zone, and it was perfect for me. It worked brilliantly. Then I tried, the biofeedback is a psychological technique to see if you can, you know, work better on your mind. Don't get me wrong. I'm not crazy. I just try to do the best that I could to perform, because I felt that there was a percentage of my performance that was too self-judgmental, or I was too much looking or judging the actual things that I did in the field. So what happened? And it happened while I was doing the things. So if I was in a very good form physically, that was, I would say, that would compensate, offset these kind of feelings. But if I didn't was at the top of the form, that would impact my performance, because if by chance I made one or two errors and, you know, people started, you know, complaining about that, I would feel it and I would even play even worse. And that's a nightmare. So honestly, this is the first time I open myself like that, because it's not a problem. I mean, I think it's in the head of most of the players out there. But being good and being better means to, you know, being good at, you know, forgetting about the mistakes and, you know, leaving football and leaving your performance in a lighter way. Maybe I would have done even better from a performance point of view. And then I heard Arsene Wenger saying that 80% of the success of a player is done by the club. So it's up to the club. I mean, it depends on the club you play with, your rate of success. And that made me feel a little bit better, because, you know, when you're part of a club and sometimes when you relegate, you feel guilty. And to go back to your question, Grant, you feel guilty. Now you feel guilty in relation to and towards the people and the fans that sometimes are, you know, too fanatic. You don't accept that. You don't understand the fandom. You don't understand the faith that they have in the club and what the club represents for them, because maybe it's 1 or 2 years that you've been playing for that club. But at the end of the day, you feel guilty. And personally, I felt guilty. I felt like it was a stain in my career. Of course, it's like, you know, something bad happening. But, you know, hearing someone that says that there's a very good percentage, very high percentage of the success of a player is dependent on the club, makes you feel a little bit better. And I believe that's true.
So Federico, just some of the things you said there have got me thinking about this this dual life that you were leading, becoming a pro player and taking a degree course. You know, and I remember in the sort of 70s and 80s when I was a kid watching football in the UK, very famously, Steve Highway of Liverpool was you know, regularly touted as the only player in English football to have a degree at the time. It was almost a black mark on his character that he'd gone to university and come out with a degree. You would think that would change over time, but it seems to have gone the other direction. It seems you are a rarity in that you have done a full college course at the same time as training. You know, it's not like American college sports where you're gaining exposure to both academics and what is essentially professional sport. So how did you juggle the two? How did you manage to focus on your studies and commit the time and the effort and the mental intensity needed to become a professional athlete?
I think that was my, can you say, hidden S? Or in some cases, the things that helped you doing the things that you do, because a balance between football and studies was the thing that helped me I would say go through and overcome the difficult and tough moments that naturally you find in your path. So I'll tell you a story. I was football. I was football. I was studies. When I say studies, I mean I was student. And then I was family. This was the three things in my life. Few other things, but very few things. Very few discotheques. I think one of the first times I went to a disco was when I was 27 or 28. I was a professional player. This is fun. This is funny to say. But anyway, so, and that's the strange thing is that playing football and you have to study, and of course you dedicate most of your week to football, you need to have your books with you, right? You need to have your books with you when you go on a away game, okay? So I remember pulling out my books from my bag and hiding myself in the bus seat, because I didn't want anybody to think that I was just studying and not thinking of the game. Because that was the kind of attitude and in some cases the culture that still is around someone studying and playing football. You know, your mind is not 100% focused on what you should be focused on because you're thinking of studying. And on the other, on the contrary, when I was a student and I was in my classroom and sometimes I heard my teacher say, yeah, you're good at studying, you know, you shouldn't lose your time playing football. I mean, you're such a good student. Why do you lose your time playing football? So I've managed myself in these two kinds of, you know, not very comfortable environments. But I would say, I say that I was successful because I've become a Serie B player in Italy and I've graduated. I've taken a degree. Well, first, my high school, I was the only student with the maximum mark, which is 60 out of 60. This is a good, I'm proud of this. And that was scientifically CEO, which I don't know the translation into English, but it's a scientific, it's a good school. And then I was pretty successful at university as well. So I think this is like what Coelho said is your Eden, your enemy within, I would say, which is your inner force in some respect, because if someone criticizes you, in some cases gives you the strength to go on and to prove that they are wrong. So, but honestly, this is what I've done, and I have always felt uncomfortable saying to my teammates. You know, everyone was happy in terms of my teammates respect respected the fact that I was a student and a good student. Everyone was, I think, even honestly proud of me that I was good at school. But I didn't see the same, I didn't have the same feeling of coaches and managers and even the football clubs themselves. Because, you know...
Federico, this was what I was going to ask you, but you've introduced it in a slightly different way. So you're saying a little bit that maybe the coaches and certainly the clubs thought you were a little bit strange. What I want to ask you is about Italian coaches. You know, those of us that have been exposed to Italian football for a long time know that they've always had that edge tactically. They've always been special. And as now the game has globalized, they've found themselves at the very top of the global game in the big leagues, whether that's Italy or Spain. Tell us a little bit the pros and cons in your mind of the Italian coach compared to other nationalities.
Unfortunately, I haven't been coached by some other nationalities. From managers coming from other countries. My dream was to come and play in England. You know that. I would have loved to go to UK to play football. I tried because I love the English football. So I would follow when we started to have the UK football or the English Premier League or Football League being televised in Sky Sports in Italy. I was a fan of that kind of football, and I thought I was a good fit for English football because I was a physical player.
Yeah, you were a box to box midfielder, really.
Yeah, that
kind of player.
So, and I remember I was on a study holiday in England, and maybe I'm going out of your question, but it comes to my mind, and I would play, I remember playing a five-a-side game with English lads, and my host family brought me to this tournament where you know, it was brilliant. It was a different, you know, those kind of green grasses, green parks, so that smell the grass. I remember that. But I don't have experiences with foreign coaches. What I can tell you about Italian coaches are very well prepared, generally speaking. I've had Orrico in Serie B. Orrico was a coach of Inter Milan as well. I don't know if you remember.
No, of course I remember. Luca and then Inter Milan.
Yeah, and then you remember the cage of Orrico. He invented the cage. You know the cage?
Yeah, I do know. Explain that, yeah.
Yeah. And it was a very good tactic. It was very, very good tactic. I mean, it was a bit crazy with trainings. I remember we were trained, I don't know, 11 or 12 times a week. Almost every day, twice a week. Very short training sessions, like 1 hour and 15 minutes, with an interval. We said, I give you a break, and then... And he can have an apple or a piece of pie, and then we started the second session. So it was all the time. I was at the training ground all the time. That was a good anecdote. Anyway, I can't tell you one thing. I think Italian coaches are very good psychologically, tactically. They're very well prepared. Now we date as well. I haven't lived that season. I haven't lived the season that they. Data-backed analysis and match analysis and video analysis. Back in my time when I remember playing in Serie C, we started seeing the games and the matches of our next opponent, and I was on a VHS or it was a disc. In any case, we didn't have Y-Scout. Y-Scout actually started in 2006. And so it was. I didn't see that kind. I would have loved that because I think I was even a student playing football. But in any case, that was not part of our weekly routine. But I can tell you I had very good coaches, very good managers, and I think Italian the level in general of Italian manager is very good. I heard your comments about the fact that I think it was the last episode of this podcast, correct me if I'm wrong, when you made a comment on the fact that comparing to England, Italy is a better, I'm simplifying it, but Italy is a better defense. Or in any case, they are better.
Yeah, I did say that.
In style, you know, of, I totally agree with you in the term, meaning that I believe that if you are able to defend, if you don't, if a team doesn't score, at least sooner or later you are able to score to them. So you're able to, if you're able to have a zero, this is logical, but it's not easy to gain. If they don't score you, sooner or later you score them. If you have good talent in your team. And of course, Italian coaches and managers, Italian managers are very focused on the defensive part. This is true because I think it's even the easiest part to coach if you think. So it depends on I don't know if you call it a module, the way you play, if it's a 4-4-2 or 3-5-2.
The formation,
The formation. But so I remember doing lots of hours and hours of training, you know, the shadow kind of play when you play without an opponent from a defensive perspective.
Yeah, just positional work.
Positional work and then two against one, you know, situational work. So about lots of things, lots of tactical and work on defense. This is true. And maybe we are not that good from an offensive point of view. You know, Zeman is one of the fathers of offensive football. Sacchi revolutionized Italian football in this respect. I think that from Sacchi on, we started playing an offensive kind of football. And even if we keep being defensive as an approach to football, I don't know if you agree with me. But yes, so my question is, I can't compare Italian managers to foreign managers because I didn't have one, but I can tell you that Italian managers are very well, managers are very good. Some cases I met managers who were not very good from a relationship standpoint with the players, you know. When you need to manage a group of people, and sometimes this is complicated. So you need that's a tremendously complicated job because you need to be good to explain your style of play to the players. They need to understand it. They need to breathe it and feel it. You need to be good at organizing training sessions, and you need to be good at managing the atmosphere in the locker room and the psychology of the players, which is rather complicated.
Federico, let's talk a little bit. It's interesting to hear you talk about your strong desire to play in England because you know, in the 80s, it was an incredibly aspirational thing for an English player to go and play in Serie A. It was the highest quality league in the world. And very few English players actually made the grade. I mean, as English fans, you're very well aware of the players that were successful over in Italy. How has the Italian view of English football changed over the last 20 years? And why do you think it is that when you look at Premier League history, we've had, you know, some astonishingly successful Italian players, you know, Zola and Vialli obviously at Chelsea and a few more scattered through. But when you look at the number of Italian players to really become major stars in the UK compared to, say, Germans or French players, it seems surprisingly small. Is that a reflection on how Italy sees British football or Italians' preference for a different style?
I don't know, Grant. I think, yes, maybe that's a physical kind of football, more physical than I think Italian football is physical. I can tell you. I mean, I played it lots of matches, and I tell you it is physical, but maybe not that physical. I don't know, but I might be contradicted because when you mention Zola or Vialli or Di Canio as well, these are talented players, and they they were very successful in England. So I don't think this is the case. I think it's more of a cultural wall. There's a barrier for Italian players to go and play in the UK, maybe even the language. I don't know. I was always fascinated by the language. You know, not just English, all languages, by the way. But my passion for the UK and England actually came because when I was in high school, my English teacher organized a study holiday, 2 week study holiday, and I was in Stratford upon Avon and Chester. I spent six times, 2 weeks each year in these places, and I fell in love with England, but apart from football, and I remember watching, you know, Wimbledon on the TV with my landlady, you know, all these kinds of feelings. I'm being, you know, the English tea, all these kinds of things I've lived before even playing football. And then I wanted to leave, and then I started watching English football and all these packed stadiums with no stands, with the fans ready to jump in, as is happening lately in English football, I might add. But and I was fascinated by English football, and then I just wanted to have an experience and to try a new experience. And that I contacted, by the way, it's curious that you mentioned Gianluca Vialli, Roger, because and Grant, because when I played for Cremonese, I played for Cremonese for 3 seasons, and you know that Vialli plays.
Yeah, that's his club.
Exactly, from Cremona, and I met a person, we would go to a pasticceria, so sort of a bar, and we would speak with the local fans, and there was this woman, and she said, and I remember sharing with her the fact that I loved English football, and she said, you know, why don't you talk with Gianluca Vialli? Why don't you speak with him? He's a friend of mine. And actually, and she created a contact between me and him. This is incredible. And he called me. Gianluca Vialli called me on the phone when I was not a Cremonese player anymore. And he says, hey, I know that you know my friend. What can I do for you? I say, Gianluca, please, if it's possible, I would love to play for an English club. And he said, no, I know someone. To speak with this guy. He was an agent. I spoke with this guy. I sent him my CV, and then nothing happened. But it was a strange story.
This is the something that I wanted to ask you about, because this is one of my pet peeves. So at the time you're talking about Italian football is the top of the world, and English football is struggling with hooliganism and old stadia and everything like that. And then British football gets its act together, and Italian football clearly and patently does not, because, and I can say this quite clearly, there's a lack of leadership and political will at the centre. So you then go to the middle of that in Serie B, and you see this from the inside. So as candidly as you can, tell us, Federico, what are the limitations of competence, political will, desire to get Italy back to where it was in the 90s?
It's difficult to answer. I think there's more than one reason. When Italy lost to Sweden for the World Cup qualifying, everyone thought that there was a tipping point for, you know, a sort of a restructuring of Italian football. I don't know. I don't think many things have happened, and I don't think we've taken the right path. We have a problem of there's a governance issue. That's for sure. We have people owning clubs that, honestly, I don't want to say that for everyone, because Roger, we have
good examples. Yeah, good
examples. But in general, these people do this because for their own interests. they might be interested in club, but that's marginal. I mean, they have other interests. Let's face the truth. They have other interests. They might be political interests. There might be, you know, someone sometimes you start knowing about someone because he's the president of that club, not because of what he is. So, and they, you know, the fact that we see, you know, clubs failing and going bankrupt on a, you know, and this is happening all the time. Clubs who are in the red, you know, Serie B clubs that give you just, they are like 2.5 or 3 million of average loss every season. And this is not just Serie B clubs.
It's just incredible.
This is even Serie B clubs. So when you live, but this is the you know, the normal state of affairs. We have a lack of resources, of course, because when you have a lack of governance and you live by the resources that Serie A is taking from the mutuality, which is the money that comes from the selling of the TV rights, and then we have this distribution system of resources that allows other leagues and other clubs, you know, the minor leagues to get resources from Serie A. But this is not enough because there's a problem of business model in the clubs, I believe. So clubs should be concentrating and focused on the fans. This is not just taking from marketing books, but this is the truth. I mean, this should be fan-centric organization, but the fans are, you know, the last thing that they're worried and concerned about and they're focused about. You know, they're fans sometimes are more of a problem in some respects. So there's a problem with infrastructure. We have very old buildings and stadiums. I think it's 60 years old of average age, and despite all the discussion and arguments on the law, there should be a law on the stadiums. You know, there's very few movements and very few changes to you. Juventus did his own stadium. I think it's the only club who managed to do it and in a reasonable amount of time. Now we are, you know, there's a discussion between Genoa and Sampdoria to do the stadium together. AC Milan and Inter Milan, they might do that. They should do the stadium together. But it's, you know, it's a very long process. And I think
Fede, you're right in all of that. There isn't really the political will, and everybody's very selfish. But you know, you're a Milan fan, and you said that at the start. I want to ask your opinion on this. You know, Italy's got three of its very biggest clubs in a state of what one could call deep, deep turmoil. I'm talking about Milan, I'm talking about Inter, and I'm talking about Roma. All three are owned by foreign investors. Roma is owned by Grant's friend Jim Palotta. From the outside, these great brands, these great clubs, what is it that you think they're doing wrong?
For AC Milan, you know that I'm an AC Milan fan, but I'm speaking not from perspective. I think there's no continuity. Can you say continuity? I mean, there's all...
That's the word, yeah.
Yeah, continuity. I mean, it's when you change and change and change, and then you go through this kind of, you know, continuous changing, and there's no possibility and opportunity to build. But this is not just for AC Milan. When you change the manager after the third loss, and this is the rule, this is not an exception, where are we supposed to go as a system? When you don't do your homework and try and find and hire the best possible manager for your style of play, for your club, for your fans, and you don't, and you just take the first one that might help you, and then when things go wrong, you sack him. Where do we want to go in terms of? I'm talking just about the sports side, but that's, you know. So I think we lack this kind, not just for AC Milan. Maybe Inter is in a more advanced stage at the moment than AC Milan. They had this Tohir era, and now they
I'm not sure, Fede. I'm not sure.
I mean, let me finish my.
Sure.
So I'm just saying that now with the Chinese, with the Suning group, I know some guys at Inter. You know, the perception is that they are trying to do the right things, and I think I see Milan, AC Milan, at a it's has a gap. There's a gap between them and Inter at the moment. I don't like to say that because I'm an AC Milan fan, so I'm not particularly passionate about the blue and blacks. But at the same time, I have to admit that they are, even from a communication perspective, you know that I've worked in marketing and communication at the league, so I'm trying to see, you know, Inter is doing a very, very good job from the content point of view. I know some guys who work for them, so very good professionals. But honestly, the problem is that the gap with Juventus is enormous. It's huge. So it's not, doing what they're doing is really not enough. Even AC Milan, I mean, it's not enough. I mean, if you want to make a difference, you need to close the gap with Juventus. And I'm afraid this gap is getting bigger and bigger every year. Because if we follow, you know, there's a, they call it a virtuous circle. When you win, you get more money, you buy the best player, and you keep winning. That's a virtuous circle of football, right? And so this is what's happening. This is what is happening with Juventus, with the difference that Juventus is not, we're not happy. Juventus is not happy, I guess, now to be in the Italian league. And the other clubs are not happy to play with Juventus because there's too much of a difference. So
polarization.
It's a big problem. It's a big issue, and we are living a very strange. It's very, I wouldn't say disruptive time in the history of football, but something has to change. And I believe, I don't know what you think about the Super League, all these discussion on the Super League, and but I think they are thinking of doing the Super League very seriously.
They are. They definitely are.
Yeah, so I'm wondering what will happen with the national competition then, and it might be a good turning point. I don't know. So to go back
But Federico, continuing on the point, you know, you mentioned Juventus, which is more traditionally Italian. You can't get than that. That's a family owned business. You've got the other three clubs that are owned by foreigners. Elliot owns Milan, Americans. Palotta, American, owns Roma, and Chinese own Inter. Would you not think that this is showing the fact that it's not easy to come in and run a serious football club if you don't have a deep understanding of the cultural history? That's what I think is the case. I see all these foreign companies, owners, coming in and just making every mistake under the sun because they haven't really understood what you need to do to swim through the pool of sharks that is Italian football.
I totally agree with you. When I said continuity, in reality, I wanted to say stability. Sorry, I want to go back to the point. Stability means Juventus. You know, that's a family. It's been a family for I don't know how many years, and with the with all the you might like it or not, Juventus, but I can't say, you know, that gives you an idea of stability, gives you an idea of a club with strong roots. So I totally agree with you. You know, in some cases, these new owners want to treat the club as any other activities or enterprise that they have. in some other parts of the world, and doing football in Italy is a special business. Doing football in general is a special business, but doing football in Italy is even more of a special business. And so, and I sometimes honestly see the, I don't know now, I don't know the right term for this, but the, it's not disappointment, the frustration. You see the frustration of these professional working for the Italian clubs, having to deal with foreign owners, you know, sometimes not understanding the logics of Italian footballs. This happens sometimes with professional coming from other worlds, not just owners. When you take some marketing, some guys or girl or a woman or a man being successful in some other sectors or industry, and they get hired from a top club, you know, sometimes they don't know the language of football as well.
Absolutely.
So that's the same from another perspective. It's the same things that's happening in terms of human resources. Sometimes it's cool to say, you know, I've taken this one from, I don't know, X company. Well, I've taken this one, and this looks cool from the outside and even from the inside. But then in reality, you might be much better off taking some guy coming from a sports marketing course, or some guys that actually grew up inside the organization. And so
that's so true.
That's from AS Roma. I think that there's an even more complicated scenario, because doing football in Rome, I think it's even more difficult than doing football in Milan. I don't know if you ever...
No doubt about that. Absolutely no doubt about that. And I'm sure Jim Palotta still hasn't really understood that.
Yeah, I spent 1 year in Rome for the military service. So I've done the military service in the in a special corp, which is called the Compagnia Atleti, which is the special, do you say corp? The special...
Core
of,
yeah,
of
CORP.
Yeah, of the army dedicated to sports athletes, to professional athletes. This is till when the military service was compulsory, right? And that was till 1986 people born. So I was 1973, but I had to postpone it because of my university study and so on. But I had to do it in the end. And I was in Serie B, and I was, you know, I spent 1 year in Rome, going back and forth from Rome to Treviso to play football, and I had a chance to leave Rome, and I tell you, I've never seen such football environment. I mean, everyone is involved with football, everyone, from 80 years old to 8 years old, even 4 years old. And everyone, if you take a cab, there might be 100% a radio station talking about the clubs. I don't know how many, 30 radio stations for AS Roma, 20 for Lazio. Incredible. And it's very, very crazy. Difficult to be successful because there's too much pressure and, you know, the environment is too hot. So honestly... This I understand, man. They've done very good things, honestly. Even from I'm you know, referring to their marketing, to the fan engagement, you know, Paul Rogers, all the things that they did.
With he's superb. Yeah.
So they did very good things, and this is clearly coming from the American approach. They have a very good, talented Italian team in terms of professionals in the back end, but I believe that Roma has an issue. I mean, an issue. It's part of the culture. It doesn't allow them to perform the way they could if they were in another city.
No, you're right. But let's take that word culture. And we talked about how that's held back the centralization of the sport, the governance of the sport, the marketing of the sport, and it's fell behind other countries. You now are, I would say, the archetypal candidate to like try and change that, because you're an ex-footballer, you're educated, you've done a whole lot of studies, and you've got multilingual cultural background. Tell me how what you're doing at YLab, which is the sport accelerator and incubator, is the driving force for the change in structures, infrastructures, and culture in Italian football.
Yeah. So YLab was founded 3 years ago. So we're relatively young. We are a startup ourselves. And we position ourselves, let's say, in a very complex ecosystem made by, on one hand, sports organizations of all kinds, federations, clubs, athletes, teams, brands, sports, what we define sports tech brands, which is companies having to do with sports and technology. And then on the other, startups, investors, the investor world and the research world, university and research. And we are in the middle just to trying to link innovation and technology to sports, right? Does it make sense? So this is what we do.
Absolutely.
It's a very compelling job, very fascinating. And seeing from my perspective, when I decided to take this job, I was I'm very enthusiastic, because I have the opportunity to do what I wasn't able to do. I didn't manage to do by the inside. I mean, when I was at the league, you know, bringing innovation into sports is a big task. It's a very challenging one. And YLab is the first sports tech incubator in Italy, is the only private incubator, sports tech incubator in Italy. And we need to have that vision and a mission to bring innovation into sports, and especially to football, which is the world I know more than any other. So now I'm speaking with the clubs. I'm meeting regularly with top flight Italian clubs and sports organizations. And see if we can talk about open innovation, startup competitions, innovation into their own sports. What are the areas and the challenges that they're facing? What are the areas of development? Where is innovation in their agenda? If YLab can help this organization to innovate, as innovation is the driver of success, we believe that it has to be something important in the priorities of clubs and sports organization agenda and priorities. So this is what we do. Yes, I mean, the task is compelling indeed.
Federico, how willing have you found Italian clubs to embrace technology? Because they are very traditional. Certainly that's the sense I get from overseas. Have they opened their arms to this, or is it kind of begrudging that they've realized that technology is going to play a bigger and bigger part in their futures?
Well, it depends. Well, first of all, I can't tell. I haven't the clear picture, because I've started 5 months ago. I haven't met with all the clubs. I've met top flight and non-top flight clubs, and I can tell you there's a difference between the two. Top flight clubs, I would say the ones who are maybe have more of international vision and international horizon, I would say, they are thinking about innovating. I don't know if they're doing that right, but in some cases they have some division, internal division, that is done by more than one person, and they are trying to become what we call an entertainment company, which is the change in business model from what Ferran Soriano says a circus and an entertainment company. You know, football clubs have always been close to a circus, in terms of business model. But now they are transitioning to a more an entertainment company business model. I think this is true for big clubs, not necessarily for medium-sized clubs. And this is what is making a difference between a club who has an international dimension and clubs who have a localized dimension. So depending on the clubs, they have different priorities. I think medium-sized clubs in Italy, they don't think of innovation in the terms we think of it. So there's no technology. There's no room for that, and especially the structure of the clubs is mainly concerned and focused on the sports side, which honestly should be linked to innovation, because if you want your clubs and teams and players to perform, you should think about all the innovation that regards players' performance and all the, you know, those kinds of devices that you can use to improve the performance of the players, improve the trainings, all the big data that you can use for enhancing the performance of the clubs. I'm not saying that this is not done. As a matter of fact, Y-Scout is a widely used tool from the match analysts, but this is restricted, I guess, to this area. They don't go to, for example, we know that there are lots of, I think, a good percentage, Roger, correct me if I'm wrong, of startups in the world right now that are around fan experience and fan engagement.
Oh, absolutely.
But I don't see clubs embracing that kind of startups. I mean, this is just a technology and I say a startup exercise. But at the moment, there's lots of chats and talks about fan engagement and fan experience, but I don't see clubs embracing fan experience the way I would like to see, pushing hard on innovation. The other thing is stadiums, you know, what we call smart arena, connected stadiums. That has lots to do with infrastructure. So if you don't have a stadium, you can't do that. But there's no concern about that. And even big data analytics, even a club, all the things that all the softwares that clubs can use for CRM, or what we call FRM for fans, fan relationship management, software tools that allows you to manage the identity of your fans. This is paramount. This is fundamental if you want to generate new revenue streams for clubs. But I don't see this as part of the daily discussion in clubs. Maybe this is part of the top clubs discussions, but I don't see, you know, the rest of the system following. This is what I think is the situation right now.
Absolutely, and I think you've hit the nail on the head. That I think in Italy they're a little bit behind in all of this, especially on the fan side. You yourself and your group have led it. You know, you mentioned Y Scout, which is a global leader. I think Y Lab is going to be the same. And I want to come back to one of the things you mentioned and link to one of your own personal experiences. You're currently looking at a company called Zone 7, which is about predicting injuries in advance and allowing teams to manage to reduce the amount of injuries. So I want to ask you, when you think back to the fact that your career took you to get a trial for Milan that went well, and then you end up failing the medical.
Yeah, that's funny now to remember. That's funny to remember. Yes, it was not a trial. It was actually a contract that I signed for AC Milan, and it was for Monza. Back in time, Monza was a satellite club. Do you say satellite club of AC Milan?
Absolutely, that's what you do. That's what you say.
And I was successfully ending my first year of professional football in Serie C2, which is the fourth division. Now there's no more Serie C2. It's disappeared. We have only three professional tiers of football. But anyway, I signed for AC Milan. Then I was asked to do the medical checkup, and I remember I had a visit from the club's doctor the day before having the medical checkup in a hotel room, which was pretty strange. But, you know, I was young and I came from a small club, and, you know, AC Milan for me was a big thing. So, and this doctor told me, I see your knee is a bit swollen. And I said, well, swollen, I don't know. I mean, I've played all the games this year and I have no problems at my knees. So, okay, but let's do a magnetic resonance. Do you say magnetic resonance or RMN, something like that?
MRI, mate.
So I did a medical checkup, and I went home, and I didn't suspect anything, because honestly I was totally healthy, and I remember I had just graduated in economics, and I had planned a trip to Mexico with a friend of mine who was a teammate of mine. So we planned this trip, and we had to leave the day after. And I received a phone call from my mother. I was already at the airport saying, don't go, don't leave, because AC Milan found a problem with your medical checkup. And I say, what's the problem? That's a problem with your knee, blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, I go to Mexico because that's my trip. I felt that this was wrong in some cases, and it was wrong. But I left. I went to Mexico. And why I tell you this? Because in Mexico, I broke my leg. So in Mexico, I was playing football. I was playing football on the beach in one of the small tournaments that Villaggio had organized, and I broke my leg. I broke my leg. Incredible. And that was a total coincidence. So I had to explain to my new club that found some strange activity in my knee. That in the meantime, I had broken my leg. So my position was not easy. I went back to Italy, and I went to three famous doctors, and they said, your knee is perfectly fine. No problem at your knee from a physiological point of view, whatever. But, you know, in the meantime, I had broken my leg, and we didn't want to go to a sort of a legal case with AC Milan, if I may call that. I had a small agent at the time, so we didn't want to discuss with AC Milan, and I was worried that they could even, you know, disrupt my career in some cases. So I decided to quit, and we didn't deposit the contract. And that was very strange. When I tell this story, you know, it's difficult to believe, because, you know, you say, why should a club do something like that? You know, for many reasons, because maybe they had some other players. They changed their mind or whatever. They wanted to prove that I was not the right player for them, for many reasons. But this is the truth. So I bounced back from my injury, and I went back to Serie B in any case in 2 years with another route. So that was my experience with the medical, but this is truth.
Well, we began with you on the terraces at AC Milan, following the team as a fan, and then you know, we end with you almost getting to play for him, which is a perfect way to wrap it up. Unfortunately, obviously, not the great outcome that you wanted, but it brings our podcast full circle and in perfect time, because we've run out of time. Unfortunately, Federico, it was a fantastic hour and 15 minutes. It's flown by. Thank you so much for taking the time to follow us. And please let people listening know how they can find out more about what you're doing with YLAB.
Yes, you can find me on Twitter at Federico Smanio, as my name and surname. On LinkedIn, on Federico Smanio. And of course, you can follow the YLAB channels, YLAB Incubator. In Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn.
Federico, thanks so much for doing that in English. I thought that was a fantastic interview, and I'll see you very soon, mate.
Fantastic. Federico, thank you once again from both of us.
Thank you.
Well, Rog, another week, another conversation. These things just fly by, just fascinating. I can't even imagine what it must be like to get that close to playing for your boyhood club and then have it all fall over at the last. What an awful thing to have happen.
Yeah, and he's such a nice guy that's got a really positive attitude. I found it interesting that he himself felt that that level of sensitivity was actually a downside in the progression of his career. And maybe you do have to be a flat track bully to get on in sport and just close everything else out.
Or just a mercenary, you know, just that's what I was interested to hear his thoughts on what it feels like to be relegated. Because, you know, as a fan, you really don't get that feeling. Yes, the day the relegation is confirmed, you see the players trudge off the pitch with their heads in their hands. But I don't know, as a fan, a lot of the players, you just don't get the feeling that 2 days later they're not out driving their Bentley and over it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think he also had an amazing experience at the league, where I know he did to try to do so many things for the clubs, and he just all often got blocked and frustrated by their own selfishness, which is true about all leagues, but in Italy especially, it's just a thankless task. And he's such a lovely guy, and what he's doing now is really, really exciting.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Well, look, as I said, we've come to the end of another podcast. Well, all that remains is for us to thank you very much for listening. Please rate and review us on iTunes. Tell your friends, get them to download the podcast, and let's see if we can get a few more fanboys along to the site. In the meantime, please follow us on Twitter at EntertainedR. That's the word A-R-E. And you can follow me on Twitter at TTMYGH.
And you can follow me at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Rog, as always, a pleasure,
Thank
mate.
You.
I will talk to you again soon.
Take care, Grant. Bye-bye.
Bye.